could snap shut like a cougar's jaws. "No running off for advice from your friends," she smiled. His own smile was as tight as her deployment. "Just for a drink. Want one? A beer." She tipped her head at the laughing throngs, foam drying on their beards. "If there's any left." He shouldered through the crowd, face brushed by bulging bellies and sweaty arms. It stunk like men who've spent too long working, playing, or both. He smiled at strangers' encouragement, their playful taunts, and returned from the bar with two heady mugs. Play resumed. A discussion of the moral implications of Lord John abdicating his throne, and thus abandoning his responsibility to his subjects, to save Lady Heron from the underworld, resulted in a rhetorical stalemate. Dante argued his duty to his war-threatened kingdom outweighed his duty to his wife, while Waring argued that a man who won't attempt to save that which is dearest to him is unfit to rule a kingdom in the first place. On the board, Waring advanced and retreated methodically, rhythmically, her drakes weaving among his lines like a shuttle through the loom. At times her forces showed patterns with no identifiable strategic goals, as if she were playing more for the aesthetics than for the thrill of the challenge or the nulla favors earned from victory. Dante leaned back in his chair. Until now he had been thinking of the game purely in the abstract, analyzing it within the strict rules of its own internal logic. Position his spearmen just so as to block the enemy's drakes. Keep his slingers in motion, reducing oppositional accuracy. Play his card of blood debt on the same turn the bulk of his Norran swordsmen were in position to strike. On some level, he'd realized the game must have emerged as a way for city-bound Norran to settle disputes their earlier, wilder, free-ranging ancestors had settled, and still did in the case of the Nine Pines and others, through blood and steel, under harsh and silent skies. But there was another level to Nulla Dûn, too. It wasn't just a practical game. It was a game of the Norran's own spirit. A celebration of their talents, their skill with their hands, and their sheer love of fun for its own sake. A chance to express one's own being and witness another in similar expression. And then, in victory or defeat, to give or receive something tangible, if only the memory of a wonderful dance or song, and so appreciate each other all over again. This understanding lent him no tactical advantage. Knowledge of her cards was enough to slip the noose around her neck. Waring was highly skilled, but not one of the highest masters, and when his bear cavalry pressed her gnomes against the shore of a lake, the pesky skirmishers were eliminated to a man. But when his sorcerer finished its turn, and Waring extended her finger to topple her last drake, Dante knew he hadn't allowed her to see the nature of himself. Worse yet, perhaps he had. He hadn't played the game. He cheated. And he had won.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents The Cycle of Aron, The Complete Trilogy. Written by Edward W. Robertson. Read by Tim Gerard Reynolds. Chapter 5. Peregrine's smile made Dante want to wring his well-bred neck. The man held the parchment at arm's length, as if he didn't want Waring's bare signature to come too close and taint him. After a long moment of admiration, he rolled up the writ of Nulla, stuffed it in his desk, and turned that smile on Dante. "I sold the Clan of the Green Lake to Lord Cassander of Beckenridge. The estate is some miles east of Setevan. If he hasn't broken up the sale, and I believe he just sunk his latest mine, so I don't see why he would, you'll find them there." Dante thanked him stiffly. Let's hope the right price can convince him to part with them regardless of his plans. Peregrin turned to gaze at the woven faces of his ancestors hanging from the wall. Well, there's always a price, isn't there? And often a later one to boot. The Lord gave him a curious look, but Dante turned on his heel. The carriage descended through row houses and a crisp sunlight that was too early in the season to be warm. They rattled over the bridge, smelling fresh water and wind-borne pollen, and halted in a plaza on the eastern shore. He relayed Peregrin's intelligence to Gala and Morn. Go tell your clan to get ready to move. I have one last thing to do before we leave.
Don't tell me it's another game,
Blaze groaned.
I hope you didn't have plans for the rest of the week.
What?
It wasn't that boring, was it? 2 weeks of watching you read books and play an even dorkier version of chess. I'd have more fun learning to piss through my eyeballs.
Dante's grin faded. No more games. Just one last debt. As they entered her dark shop, Waring's face folded as fast as her troops had in the final battle.
I already know what you want.
And for that, I'm sorry. Dante met her eyes. But I didn't come here to claim my nulla. I'm here to pay you mine. She laughed, deep and bitter.
Beaten by a human who doesn't even know the rules. Do you think I'd be shamed, more or less, if I killed myself before I finished your order?
I know the rules perfectly well. Now close this shop and take me to your father. Waring drew back her head.
He lives on the far north of town.
I spend a fortnight playing games. I think I can fit a few more hours into my busy schedule. Even so, Dante hired another carriage, spending most of what little he'd gained selling nulla and placing side bets on other games. Wheels splashed mud and other substances across unpaved streets. A score of hammers rang from a dozen anvils. The metallic clanks faded by the time shacks replaced the proper houses. After a half mile of dirt alleys and thatch-roofed single-room homes, Waring called a stop in front of one no different from a thousand others. She stepped into the cold dust, pausing before a door that fit worse than an older brother's hand-me-down trousers.
Give me a minute.
She slipped inside, tugging the door several times before it squeaked shut. Low tones filtered through the drafty wallboards, one voice female, the other male and coarse as a raven. Clinks, shuffles, and clatters overcut the talk, as if many small things were being converted into one large pile.
I think she's into you, Blaze said.
I hardly doubt that.
Who else cleans just because a near stranger comes to their house?
Women, Dante said. A good deal of men, too.
Just about everyone, in fact, except those whose servants do it for them.
We need to get out more, don't we?
Not if it's to the sort of places where people clean.
The door opened, pouring sunlight into a single, tight room. A blanket covered thigh-high lumps piled along the back wall. A rickety stove pumped smoke up the narrow chimney of fieldstone and clay, pouring heat into the sieve-like shack. A pale leg projected from a cot half-visible behind the doorway. The Norrin it belonged to was well past middle age. The grey of his beard had begun to seep into his dark brown hair, colouring it like milk dribbled into unstirred coffee. He had the usual flabbiness of age, but his right leg was a bony broomstick beneath grimy pants. The room smelled faintly of urine.
My father, Sean, Waring said.
Dante introduced himself and Blaze.
Your daughter's work is spectacular.
No doubt, Blaze said. I stared at one weaving of a lady so long I feared she'd reach out of the thread and slap me.
Well, she stole all she knows from me.
Sean struggled to swing his legs from the cot, bracing himself on a block of wood that served as a table.
Please don't get up, Dante said. That's why I'm here.
to gape at a cripple.
Sir, I can assure you... The old man held up a rough, warm palm.
Shut up. Waring told me why you're here. She's expecting a miracle.
And what are you expecting?
To learn one more time that I told you so is always more satisfying in your head than spoken aloud.
He lay back on the cot, glaring at the bare, cobwebby rafters.
Let's get to it.
You might want to leave, Dante said to Waring. I expect this will hurt. It did. The knee was hard and knobbly as dry coral. To set it, Dante first had to re-break it, dissolving the old mending with hard rasps of nether. Sean screamed, sweat trickling through his ashy beard. Blaze helped hold him down, offering gulps from a flask. Once the knee was disjointed, to the nether's touch it felt like loose pebbles among an internal creek of hot blood and lymph. Dante aligned the old break as cleanly as he could, filling the gaps with nether-prompted growths of new bone. Most of Dante's intensive work had been done on the vibrant young, on warriors and soldiers, not to mention himself and Blaze. And the old man's flesh and tissue responded sluggishly, accumulating and binding only through Dante's constant, steady focus on the nether. Grain by grain, the bone returned. After some time, a half hour, perhaps twice that long, Dante plopped on the floor, as sweaty as the old man. As for Sean, he regarded Dante coolly as one watches a lone wolf from across an open meadow.
Why did you come here?
Dante wiped his sleeve across his forehead. Your daughter's a very fine Nulladoon player, too.
That she got on her own. Dumb game ran me right out of business.
Despite the old man's cynicism, a decade of anticipation was etched on his face. Sean swung his leg off the bed. The skin around his eyes relaxed.
Joshin's toe, son. A man who can do what you do's got no business wasting time with games.
Dante smiled and stepped outside. Waring pulled her finger from her mouth and spat a ragged bit of nail into the dirt. Well? Better, Dante said.
Such modesty, Blaze said, eyes rolling.
That old crank'll be fit enough to kick your ass again in no time.
Maybe you can come see for yourself.
Waring glanced through the door. If you come here again.
Soon.
Dante climbed inside the carriage. In the moment, he meant it. He and Blaze could come back here on their return from the estate outside Setoven. He'd like to play Waring again, a rematch where he competed without the knowledge of every one of her cards. He would even enjoy losing, he thought. And if he won, to have a weaving made for himself. But he wouldn't return for years. When at last he did, Waring would be old herself and retired from the tables, even friendly matches. She would tell him of how Sean had healed, walking to the shop with her each morning, this time not as her master, but her partner. His earnings from weaving just keeping up with the nulla he incurred from gaming. He would die 3 years before Dante made it back to Dolandon. While Dante played, the others had worked. The boomer sails were whole and white. Bright blonde wood stood out from the railing where wind and spray chapped timber, smashed in the battle with the bloody knuckles, had since been replaced. More surprisingly, Lyra stood on the deck to greet Dante.
"Leg better," he said. "Fit to start working off my debt."
"Saving you was my idea, you know," Blaze said. "If he doesn't want to boss you around, I'll bear that burden for him."
She swept breeze-blown hair from her face. "But I do owe you." Blaze raised his brows.
"In that case, you should know I can do my fighting on my own. It's other realms where it helps to have a partner."
"I don't know," Dante said. "You seem plenty capable of handling that on your own, too."
Orlan was striding across the deck on a beeline for him.
Dante met him halfway.
"Good work of it," the chieftain said. "When we heard the Lord refused to name his buyer, we began our battle prayers to Josenjo. Hope nobody went stir-crazy during the wait."
"We are accustomed enough to waiting. That's what we do all winter. What we're not accustomed to is other people fighting our battles for us."
"Good," Dante nodded. "Because whenever I rescue a clan of slaves from the bottom of a mineshaft, I prefer to do it with 30 howling warriors at my side."
"It may not come to that," the tall man smiled. "But I hope it does."
The Boomer pushed off that same day, negotiating its way through the pilings and river traffic of rowboats and flat-bottom schooners. An hour later, Dullandun was a black mass of buildings to their back, a blocky forest of stone and hard-fired mud. Dante had a firm enough grasp on Gascon geography to know the Cricket River on which they'd been sailing this whole time was a tributary of the Roman that ran through Setevan, meaning they could more or less float the whole way to Beckenridge, debarking however many miles away to complete the journey overland. What he didn't know was how far that was. Varlin reported it was just over 250 miles, less than a week's journey if they sailed through the nights and made minimal stops. Dante had spent twice that long at Nulla Dune, but the remainder of the trip felt much longer. Towns drifted past, but none nearly as large as Dullandun. Barges came upstream and down, and on two occasions the oars of war galleys slashed the grey water, but neither vessel showed the faintest sign of interest in the Boomer. Even the land seemed to grow bored, flattening into an endless prairie of winter-yellowed grasses, hawks circling and screeching, mice and gophers ruffling the fields on their hunt for seeds, the skies clear and cool, but not quite cold and far from warm. He got out his boxes to play some desultory games of Nulla Dune with Mourne, but he was missing pieces and tiles, and the game suffered for it. He watched Blaze and Lyra practice swordplay on the deck, their blades glinting in the sunlight until the fighters' faces gleamed and their chests heaved. Lyra limped, but was able to lean and feint through all but the most delicate footwork. Out of eyeshot of Major Tans, clan warriors took to the decks too, sparring or just sunning themselves to break up the closeness below decks. On both banks, the land rose, first into yellow hills, then high bluffs with pale green shrubs and scraggly pines. The sides of the gorge were so steep, Dante could see bare rock slanted in layers, great crumbles of loose stone mounded around the feet of the cliffs. The way grew fraught with sudden bends and jutting spurs of rock. Dante stayed up through the night, lighting the way from the prow, with a white beam that flowed over black waters and cliffs. Snow capped the heights and the shadows where the sun rarely touched. The Boomer emerged from the gorge into brackets of pine-heavy hills. The air was wet and dense and deceptively cold, a damp hand that snatched your warmth while you weren't looking. That night, Varlin put to port in a small town, where the docks were slick with algae, and the log houses were fuzzy with moss. He returned from the dockmaster to confirm this was their port. Orlin held the troops below decks until all the town's lanterns, but those on the docks, had been extinguished. Then the warriors padded down the gangway, single file, as silent as snow, and gathered a short way into the woods. Dante, Blaze, and Lyra were the only humans to join them. The rest of the crew remained on board the Boomer. According to plan, the ship would shove off in the morning, then turn around after 2 days to rendezvous with the clan and its cousins upriver in something like a week. If Captain Varlin hadn't seen or heard from the clan in a fortnight, he'd be free to leave without further obligation. The clan slipped into the forest along a plain dirt road that was frequently muddy and patchy with holes. Scouts returned to let them know the way ahead was clear. V estimated a 2-day march to Beckenridge. Along with Orlin, she dropped back from the body of warriors to speak to Dante and Blaze alone, glaring at Lyra until she took the hint. With a cold nod, Lyra dropped back further yet, out of range of their murmurs, but close enough to watch their backs.
"We expect the situation at Beckenridge to be much the same as Dullendon," Orlin said.
V glanced in the direction of a hoot from the darkness.
"Except in the sense that everything will be different."
"But once again, a full body of warriors will be unwelcome, so we must present a human face instead."
"Don't worry, we're experts at pretending to be what we're not," Blay said. "Like, bathed."
"We'll use the same story we did in Dullendon," Dante said. "Less suspicious. And with the added bonus of not requiring any more work."
"I can't agree with that fast enough."
Orlin pulled his soft leather collar tight against the cold.
"As before, taking Morn and Gala should..."
The chieftain collapsed to his knees. In the darkened roadway, his head spasmed side to side, earrings flashing, as if he were attempting to shake a demon out of his skull. Spittle gleamed in the corner of his mouth. Dante knelt beside him, reaching for the nether.
"What's happening?"
V slapped his hand away, with enough force to crack walnuts.
"You mustn't touch him! Jocelyn Joe is upon him!"
Orlin's violent jerks subsided to irregular twitches. He was overcome by a stillness as perfect as the meditations of the supplicants of Urt. His eyes flicked open.
"Jocelyn Joe says the quivering bow is in the highest place, the clan of the Green Lake in the lowest. Yet, if one has two hands, both may be taken."
"You know," Blay said, "Jocelyn Joe might get more done if he said things that made any damn sense."
"The meaning of his words often comes later, in singular moments of clarity."
Orlin stood, wiping his eyes.
"We'll understand soon enough."
The march was pleasantly uneventful. Scouts watched for carriages and riders. At their whistle, the clan melted into the woods like a morning fog. On the second day, the westward path sported a northern fork, leading them through shallow, rolling hills and the sharply sweet scent of pine.
"You realize we're showing up on foot," Blay said when the scouts returned with word the manor was less than 5 miles away. "They're going to think we're the type of people who show up on foot."
"Leave it to the Norren to forget the wealthy treated their feet as the decorative bulbs at the end of their pants," Dante said.
"We'll tell Lord Cassander we were robbed."
"That'll never work."
"You're right.
Much more credible that we walked 1,000 miles from Malin before suddenly realizing what we'd left at home. Horses."
"Come on," Blay said. "Who's going to believe I could get robbed?"
Dante nodded.
"We'll tell them you look strong, but inside you beats the heart of a coward."
"How about this? You thought our map was actual size and declared we'd have no need for horses."
"We're the type of noble who boasts as much as he drinks. We decided to walk from the river to remind ourselves of ancient days, to partake of the brisk forest air, and to feel the strength of our legs beneath us."
"Suppose we'd better get drunk, then, to get in character."
The pair of forward scouts returned. Beckenridge was scant miles ahead. Orlin led the clan off trail into the woods single file. The last member dragged a stone-filled sack behind her to confuse their tracks. Miles out of sight of the manor, the Nine Pines bivouacked near a minor creek trickling between the ferns and the mossy roots of colossal red trees. Warriors turned their axes on saplings and low branches, raising inconspicuous lean-tos, while V and Orlin rehashed the plan. There existed the fair chance that, as visiting aristocracy, and foreign ones at that, Dante and Blaze would be taken in as guests, and might find it difficult to slip away. In that event, their servants, particularly Morn and Gala, would find it much easier to sneak away and get word to the rest of the clan about what was happening inside. The clan itself, meanwhile, would investigate the mine as best they could while exploring the woods for escape routes and sound places to defend from in the event enemy riders overtook them. That was it. The rest was left to chance, or rather, to their ability to improvise on the fly. Dante sent Lyra and Morn ahead to announce their presence, then cleaned up in the ice-cold creek as much as he could stand. He dried himself with a blanket and gathered up his things. Horse droppings littered the path through the pines. The forest ended on the ridge of a low hill. Beckenridge spread in the valley below. For administrative purposes, the place was a single household, yet in practical purposes, it resembled a small village. The manor itself was a giant stone structure, L-shaped, with four floors of windows and several towers rising another three stories above that. At a tasteful distance, smoke poured from a smithy, the rhythm of clanging metal trickling through the damp air. A barn and stable sat close together. A number of other simple wooden structures were arranged here and there, housing for servants and resident employees. The dirt road continued past all this, widening as it climbed the ridge on the valley's opposite side. Gala walked with them, scanning the open fields as if she expected the old tree stumps to rip themselves from the ground and tear Dante and Blaze limb from limb. Dante saw no hint of Morn and Lyra, which was either a good sign or a very bad one. At the manor, a servant waited before iron-banded double doors that could have resisted most armies. The woman led them to a warm receiving room, thick with carpets, a full shelf of books, and the scent of wood smoke, where she explained that Cassander was currently at the mines but would return shortly. Lyra and Morn were brought to the room a few minutes later, taking up properly studied positions along the wall. "See anything interesting?" Dante asked. Morn nodded enthusiastically. "A rather nice rendition of the confluence of the cricket and Roman."
"He said, 'interesting,'" Blaze said.
"If you're referring to things you can eat, the answer is no."
"There's always something to eat. It just depends on how much you want to chew."
They spent the next hour leafing through Picaroon novels and poking at the reluctant fire. At last, the door opened. In it stood a shortish man in a quilted pine-green undercoat and the blotchy complexion of one who's been riding in the cold. His blonde hair was cut severely short, a glowing fuzz above the sharp angles of his face. To Dante's surprise, he introduced himself as Cassander. Dante had expected your typical middle-aged and doughy-middled lord, not a thin man nearly as young as himself. Cassander blinked at the books spread on the low table.
"There is no tea."
"In all the world," Blaze said. "Have you checked under the bed?"
"Excuse me. I will return with tea."
Cassander did just that, personally bearing a bronze tray carrying five green-glazed mugs and a steaming clay pot. He set them on the table and poured each full, offering one not just to Blaze and Dante, but to Lyra, Gala, and Morn as well.
"I'd heard this was a strange land," Dante said in his best blustery, jovial, bring-me-a-beer-and-the-nanny voice. "But not so strange that you serve the servants."
"Everyone gets cold."
Cassander took a step from the table and gazed between his guests in the ritualistic old Gascon acknowledgement of presence that might well have been lost on Dante if he really were a travelling Malish lord and not, in fact, a Malish transplant who'd spent years attending dozens of versions of this same traditional tea greeting. Considering his station, Cassander's version of the ritual was extremely stripped down, yet respectful, a return to its historical origins. In other households, Dante had seen lords nod briefly at their guests while ignoring the servants pouring tea from emerald-crusted pots into delicate silver cups. Dante slurped tea.
"Some excellent weed juice you got here."
"We grow it ourselves."
"Funny. That's exactly why we're here, but I'm getting ahead of myself.
I will not be insulted if you want to cut straight to the point. The Lord had a soft way of speaking that made you focus on every word. Dante suspected this was deliberate. Dante grinned and made another bonhomie-heavy insight about how nice it was to cut the crap, then launched into their cover story about needing to put the best possible laborers in front of their skeptical investors, specifically the figures of the fabled Clan of the Green Lake. "They are, unfortunately for you, not for sale," Cassander said. "Have you seen any of the Clan of the Green Lake?"
"Not personally."
Blaze grinned. "Although we've heard so much about them, I could believe there are no other Norren." Cassander gazed at the cooling teapot.
"To southern eyes, they look no different from any other Norren."
"What's the difference to northern eyes?" Dante said.
"Their beards are slightly reddish."
"That's it."
"That is what I said."
Blaze cocked his head. "Then why are they so important to you?"
Cassander refilled Blaze's tea. "They and their nomad cousin clans are open supporters of Norren independence. The message they send from down my mine is worth more than anything you can offer for them."
"Don't be too sure about that," Blaze said. "In Malin, our gold grows as thickly as wheat. Our bread weighs 80 pounds a loaf."
"Then I am surprised you have come all this way for Norren, when your own farmers must have the musculature of elephants."
"Are the Norren so likely to rebel they need reminders of their place?" Dante said. "From what I hear, they're so busy exchanging treatises and crafting cups they can hardly run a village."
Cassander laced his fingers together, gazing at his paralleled thumbs.
"The Norren are restless. If they push much more obviously, several clans will soon be headless."
"Sounds like you've got them under control either way."
"I will not sell my stock. I will consider pressing the matter any further, Rude."
Dante drew back, palms raised, eyes downcast. "Not our intention at all, sir. But I hope you won't consider it rude if I ask to see them, so that when I look for stock elsewhere, I'll know for myself how close my purchase comes to the finest clan warriors in Gask."
"It is not rude. Merely pointless.
But you are guests. We will go to the mine tomorrow morning."
Neither his expression nor posture changed, but there was a sudden absence to Cassander that made it perfectly clear their discussion was done for the day. Dante made a show of stretching, remarking how long the day had been. Cassander nodded and excused himself. He was replaced by a pair of servants moments later, one of whom led Lyra and the two Norren to the servants' wing, while the other showed Dante and Blaze up a stairwell so plushly carpeted they couldn't hear their feet at all. The walls were empty of paintings, cloth hangings, statues, any of the usual trappings of status and wealth. Their two guest rooms were similarly Spartan: a bed, a reading chair, an end table, then nothing but carpet and blank walls, interrupted only by a fireplace. Dante visited the water closet, then returned to Blaze's room.
"What do you think of our host?" he said in Malish, as if Cassander might have his pale ear pressed to the door.
"That he was born 3 months premature?"
"The fact his fellow bluebloods haven't killed him and claimed they mistook him for a fox makes me think he's close enough to the throne to smell King Modigan's sweat."
"He's a second cousin or something. Are you telling me you didn't know that?"
Blaze turned to the waning sunset beyond the window. "Good work down there, by the way. You almost convince me you can hold a normal conversation."
"What? I can talk to people."
"The same way a fish can wriggle out of a boat. Lots of flapping around, and someone's going to wind up all slimy."
"If I had a club, it would be on its way to your skull right now."
Dante glanced up at the plain ceiling.
"Where do you suppose the 9 pounds bow is?"
The armory. Blaze jerked his chin at the bare walls. Judging from the other furnishings, it'll be the only thing there. Joss and Joe said it would be found in a high place. If the Green Lakes are at the bottom of a mine, the low place, where would that put the bow?
At the top of a mine?
That is definitely not the answer. At the top of an anti-mine.
Of course, Dante said. By coincidence, it's rumored your brain is hidden there too.
The attic, if this place has one.
Or one of the towers. What do I look like, a pennish bowhound? We'll ask for a tour and see what there isn't to see.
Which was actually a decent plan, given that it was low risk, unsuspicious, and might even involve a helpful friend or servant stopping to specifically point it out, with the implication that, here is the quivering bow, a Noran artifact of unsurpassed power, so what does it say that it's now in the hands of our esteemed lord? Alternately, their tour leader might go the opposite route, conspicuously leaving a part of the manor unshown to avoid revealing their secret weapon to Malish eyes. Either way, the search would be narrowed. Cassander was gone again in the morning. Something about overseeing the latest extraction, said to be especially rich. Dante asked for, and was reluctantly granted, a tour of the household by its majordomo, a man near 50 with thinning grey hair and the tight-clipped gestures of a former soldier. He led Blaze and Dante through the manor's numerous wings, floors, and cellars, pointing out ancestral heirlooms, an engraved chalice, a sapphire ring, a broken arrow, which excited Dante until the majordomo explained it had been received from Cassander's great-great-grandfather after the battle of somewhere or other. The home's notable additions, along with which estate owner commissioned them and which architect designed them, and an endless procession of guest rooms, which were of interest not for what was in them, nothing for the most part, though a handful were appropriately if archaically furnished, but for who had once slept in them, a list of historical so-and-sos whose names Dante forgot as quickly as the balding man recited them.
"Is there an armory?" Blaze said, as the majordomo returned them to the carpeted but otherwise blank hallway that opened to their rooms. "Any legendary weapons of yore? Nothing restores your sense of wonder like looking at a sword that's killed a king."
"Unfortunately, there is nothing like that in the house itself," the man said. "With Lord Cassander's permission, perhaps you might see the collection in the tower."
He glanced down and to the corner. "Yet, as with the house, the contents are austere. Our lord is ever a minimalist."
Blaze took an expression of mock affront.
"Except in his hospitality."
"Of course." The man left them to the quiet house. Cassander returned by noon, flushed from the chilly ride. After convening downstairs along with the various servants and attendants of both parties, he offered Dante and Blaze a carriage for the ride to the mine.
"Horses are our own feet," Blaze said, continuing the bravado. "Carriages separate a man from the world. You know what you get when you're separated from the world? Soft, and white enough to read by."
Dante expected one of the man's chilly rebuffs, but Cassander responded with a fragile smile.
"It will be done."
His people scattered for the stables, bringing back two fine-looking horses. For all the riding Dante had done between Narashtavik and the Noran territories, he still couldn't tell any equine differences more specific than mare or stallion. And an adequate, if less nobly statured mount for Lyra. Gal and Morn were left to accompany on foot. Cassander's troop consisted of three mounted men and two unmounted Noran of his own, who carried large packs on their broad backs. The trail curled up the hill. To both sides of the dark dirt, grass and ferns glistened in the sun, still damp. Vapor trailed from the horse's nostrils. Cassander ranged ahead. From most nobles, Dante could take this as a sign of arrogance,
the light's ongoing cruelty of constantly reminding everyone around him of their place. But Cassander's long gazes over the green fields, and his nature in general, suggested he was simply the type to wander ahead because he was lost in his own thoughts. He was an odd duck, a strange bird among the social beasts that made up the aristocracy, and if Dante didn't have more pressing matters on his hands, he would have tried to get to know the young lord. "Do you do any fencing?" Dante said instead, trying to steer their host into martial matters. "Boxing? Archery?"
"I train with the Beset," Cassander said, referring to a reed-thin blade that hadn't been popular in Gask for at least 3 generations. "It is a weapon of finesse."
"Just that?"
"It only takes one weapon to kill a man."
Blaze pushed out his lower lip. "If you don't care about having fun, sure."
"Killing is a tool, not a sport."
Cassander blinked, then offered that same fragile smile.
"I am sorry. My mother once told me I'd have to learn a blade to protect myself from my tongue."
"Smart woman." Dante pried further, but Cassander's responses turned monosyllabic until the lord shifted the discourse to chummy small talk, their trip, their families, etc. The hill apexed and began a shallow downslope into a valley cleared of trees. Trying to clear the lush landscape of all growth would have been futile, however, and the ground remained fuzzy with bushes, weeds, ferns, stump mosses, and fungus. A few miles further along the road, the land swelled again. Atop its high crown, a narrow tower jutted into the sky.
"Is that where you keep your armory?" Dante said without thinking.
Cassander looked at him from the corner of his eyes.
"My armory?"
"Your man gave us a tour of the household. We wanted to see the family arms, but he said they were kept in a tower."
"The original site of the house."
The blond man swayed with the roll of his horse.
"But it is not a good time."
"Are you that busy? Surely one of your people could show us up."
"The steps to the top are in disrepair. Reaching the armory is currently impossible."
"Damn," Blaze said. "When are they going to invent ropes already?"
Cassander gazed at the finger of stone on the hilltop.
"You would only be disappointed. There is only one item of note, acquired so recently it has not been given a proper display."
Whatever Cassander's claims, the tower looked intact and unblemished, an impression Dante confirmed when they crested the hill and rode under its noon-shortened shadow. It was a simple construction, smooth walls of white stone flecked with brown and yellow, its curves broken by narrow arrow slits. The single door was average in size, but its ring handle was bulky enough to brain a bull. Cassander stared past it as they advanced. Dante caught Blaze's eye and raised his brows at the silent tower. They reached the mine within the hour. It sat halfway up a hill, a dirty sprawl of scaffold surrounding a cave-like tunnel into the stone. Norrin emerged with buckets, shoulders bent, dust sifting from their hair. Others turned the wheel of a listless windmill, siphoning water from the depths. Smoke poured from the chimneys of a smelter. A single long barracks stood a few hundred feet away. Men with swords and bows laughed, arms folded over their chests, sparing glances at the lean Norrin hauling rubble and ore up from the torchlit tunnels. Cassander turned his horse sideways to watch the proceedings. Near the barracks, a one-armed Norrin tended pots above a fire pit. A woman limped up to set a water bucket beside him. Others emerged from the smelter, trudged to a clearing by the mine's entrance, and hefted buckets, arms and back straining, before returning to the smoking building. They showed no expression, but the occasional wince. Over Dante's shoulder, the faces of Morn and Gala were coldly blank. It is a pinnacle of the intersection of purpose and meaning, Cassander said softly, as if to himself. The labor of would-be traitors is instead turned to extracting the silver of one of the nation's wealthiest new mines. In this way, their treasonous spirit is converted into strength for the very country they would sabotage.
Pretty fit punishment, Dante said.
It's not a punishment.
I didn't mean to imply they're not well treated.
Cassander shook his head, features contracted into something sharp and eager.
You misunderstand. It is a sign.
Looks like hauling rocks to me, Blay said. I don't know what that's a sign of, other than a lifetime of shitwork.
How do we know the things we do are right? Cassander said. Praise from others? But they are just men. Their vision and wisdom limited by a mortal span and the circumscribed perspective that comes with it.
Well, obviously.
Others look to inner praise, the righteous pride one feels when one has done well. There is nothing purer than one's own spirit.
But we're just men ourselves, Dante said.
Cassander's head snapped down in a nod.
Exactly. Exactly. The praise of mortals, weak, flawed, rotting, cannot be trusted. Whose can? That of the gods, the heavens. But they do not speak to us, not in words like these. They operate by signs.
He gestured to a dust-blackened Norrin as the workers staggered to a stop, dropped two buckets with a hollow thump, and gasped for air.
The heavens are symmetry, perfection reflected and reproduced. The dirt in those buckets becomes pure silver, so the dirt in that man's rebellious soul becomes the power of Gask. Between this symmetry, we glimpse the approval of Aron.
Dante had to literally bite his tongue to prevent himself from launching into an extensive cycle-quoting counter-argument that Aron doesn't in fact care about the acts of men at all, that we are all derived from and return to the same stuff, the nether, the grist of Aron's mill, and so our time spent as men doesn't seem that significant to him at all. Instead, he said nothing. He was all but certain the quivering bow was locked in that tower with its broken steps. If he did nothing to impinge on his host's goodwill for two more nights, the bow would be his.
You did not come here to see me speak.
Cassander smiled into the silence Dante had inadvertently let grow awkward.
Careful inside. There are rocks.
Dante laughed. But Cassander's quickly hidden look of puzzlement suggested that hadn't been a joke. He provided them covered lanterns and warned them to let him know if the flame changed color, particularly green or blue. That much sounded exciting, but otherwise the mine looked exactly the way Dante would have guessed. Stone tunnels, boards planking the walls and ceiling to lock in loose rocks, grit and dust, and sweating men bunching their arms to assault the walls with heavy picks. Other Norrin gathered the rubble into buckets and lugged it up to the light. No surprises except the silver ore itself. Gnarled rocks shot through with shades of rust and blue. Yet the banality of it all was a sign of its own. The Norrin struck the wall, rested a moment, struck the wall, rested. Others knelt among the clouds of dust and swept up loose rocks. It seemed suddenly foreign, even monstrous, that Cassander should own men, the same way he owned their shovels and buckets. Not that Dante was alone in this thought. There were abolitionists wherever there were slaves. Its wrongness was simply obvious to him now, in the same way his acceptance of it had been obvious earlier that day. The servants at Narashtovic's sealed citadel. Were they slaves or paid hands? Dante had no idea. In the darkness, his cheeks flushed red. He didn't speak much on the way back, which surely suited Cassander fine. The midday sun was full, but so lacking in warmth, Dante could still see the foggy ghost of his own breath. The echoing halls of the house at Beckenridge were nearly as cool as the outdoors, but the fire in his sparse room had been kept stoked in his absence by able servants. The room was so hot his skin itched. "What do you think?" Dante said, shedding his coat and stripping off his doublet. "That you should do more push-ups," Blaze said. "About the bow, dummy." "That just maybe it's up in that tower he refused to let us see inside." "I agree with you, which makes me very scared." Blaze gestured at the squeaky boarded floor. "How much longer can we depend on a nobleman's hospitality towards his own kind? Cassander's the type of guy who wouldn't let the friends he doesn't have stay more than a few days." Dante circled the room, as if the motion would unwind the contents of his head. "We'll move tomorrow night. That will give us another day to search and the clan to prepare. Get your stealing shoes on." "Who says I ever take them off?" Dante passed word of the decision to Mourn, who promised to deliver the message that night. Dante didn't tell Gala or Lyra, the former because he didn't think she'd care one way or the other, and the latter because Lyra's earnest loyalty, she'd done nothing but play the part of a servant since arriving at Beckenridge, and almost too convenient method of meeting them on the river, had Dante privately concerned she might not be who she said she was. Which was perhaps paranoid, given the broken leg and the starvation and all, but if her life-debt nonsense was as heartfelt as she claimed, she would happily follow them into the gallbladder of the fire-squid. By contrast, accompanying them on a midnight break-in to a crumbling tower would be no trouble at all. In the morning, a bleary-eyed Mourn told them word had been passed, with Orlan planning to raid the mine at 1 a.m. In case the clan and Dante's party stayed separated, they'd reconvene at the Boomer. Dante and Blaze spent the day pumping Cassander's servants on the history and lore of Beckenridge, recruiting Mourn to do the same from his side of the social strata, hoping to induce a revelatory brag about the bow. In this way, they coaxed the Major Domo into confessing the estate's purchase of the clan of the Green Leg had come with the acquisition of a weapon of no small power. When Dante pressed for details, the man implied in the politest and most deniable terms that Dante might be a lord, but he was still a foreign lord, and it was not the Majordomo's place to reveal what might well be considered a secret of the state. Still, besides being shot with the bow itself, it was the best confirmation Dante could have hoped for. He went to bed with the same childlike anticipation he'd once felt for Falmuck's Eve, much like that day of meat pies, fermented cider, and tiny wooden one-eyed idols, it would probably be all over before he knew it. He met Blaze in the hallway at midnight, or as close to it as he could reckon by the stars. Except for the sporadic crackle of fireplaces, the manor was silent and all but completely dark. The war candles had burnt out or been put out, leaving the starlight to fight its way through the windows that had iced over in the night. Dante crept down the spiral staircase, feeling the way with his feet. If they were intercepted by anyone with the courage and authority to question them, Blaze's idea of a cover story was they were meeting with Lyra in order to arrange a surprise feast for their host, a story which they would, through awkward phrasing and embarrassed glances, in turn imply to be a cover for your typically perverse, aristocratic sex with the help. But by the time they met Lyra in the servant's kitchen, and its faded yet cloying scents of rendered fat and boiling beets, they hadn't seen another soul. She led them into the biting night. The dirt road was frozen underfoot. Frost glittered from the weeds. Dante heard no baying of hounds, saw no sudden lighting of lanterns. Under starlight, they'd be nearly invisible. He kept the nether close, its cold pulse mirrored his own. His breath swirled from his mouth, hanging in the damp air. Morn and Gala waited for them beyond the first ridge, swords on hips.
"The clan will move soon," Morn said. "Don't expect subtlety."
Blaze snorted. "You guys are 7 feet tall and weigh as much as a statue of yourselves. I don't think you do anything subtly." "This isn't just a rescue," Gala said. "It's vengeance."
"Good," Dante said. "Then Cassander's soldiers will be too busy dying to notice we're stumbling around in their tower stealing their things."
He could see it already, a finger-like silhouette rising from the opposite rim of the valley. He wanted to run to it, but maintained a brisk walk instead. The tower arrived soon enough. Standing beneath its 100-foot rise of white stone, Dante could feel every ounce of its weight. Its very star-cast shadow pressed on him, simultaneously holding him down and compelling him onward. He pulled the door's huge iron ring. The door didn't budge.
"What would you do without me?"
Blaze knelt beside the lock, an outrageously huge pad that could be repurposed as an anvil at a moment's notice.
"I'd ask Morn to smash the lock right off," Dante said. "I assumed picking it would make less noise, but I forgot that would leave your mouth as free as ever."
Blaze unfolded a leather case of narrow metal prods, hooks, and squiggly-tipped wires. When they'd first met, Blaze had been a devoted student of the school of bash it once, and if that doesn't work, bash it harder. But over the last year or two, he'd taken to practicing methods that left locks, knobs, and hinges intact, recognizing that much of their work in the Norrin territories was the kind that must be denied rather than gloated about. His interest in the skill had doubled at a party in Narashtovik at Duke Abaddon's manor, which Dante's position on the council forced them to attend. On hearing Abaddon kept his best wines beside his own bed, Blaze went upstairs, trailed by a young lady he'd been after all night. The Duke's bedroom bore not one but three locks, but Blaze had them off in seconds, so impressing the lady that it took no kits or tools whatsoever to pry her from her dress, then and there. Beneath the white tower, Blaze set to his task with uncommon sobriety, methodically wiggling a number of thin rods into the lock's keyhole, squinting into the empty night as he poked and worried the tools about its raspy interior, guided by touch and sounds far too arcane for Dante to differentiate. Exhausting one pick, Blaze swapped it out for another, and leveraged a third, thicker tool into the tumblers and latches lurking inside.
"I don't think this is happening," he said, after a couple minutes of jiggling and prying. "I guess we'll just have to forget the bow, renounce our beliefs, and return home to retire as farmers."
Blaze reached down for an L-shaped rod with a crooked little tooth at its end, inserted it into the pad, and torqued his wrist. The lock squeaked, rust flaked into Blaze's hand. He slipped the opened pad from its loops and dropped it in the grass.
"Oh, I forgot. I'm the greatest."
"Congratulations, you have the skills of an 8-year-old orphan."
Dante stepped into the darkness and lit a candle with a flicker of nether. The others crowded in beside him, accepting candles of their own. A wooden ceiling hung some 12 feet overhead, penetrated by a staircase that descended into darkness above. At its other end, it descended through the floor to an even deeper blackness below. Melted remnants of candles sat on the floor. Burnt-out torches rested in wall sconces. The ground floor was bare, except for a large wooden plank to bar the door, and a few sacks of what was, judging from the mice droppings, likely to be grain.
"I could only find the rope," Morn said, extracting it from his pack. "I hope it's enough to get past the upper stairs."
Dante tipped back his head, peering into the drafty heights.
"I doubt there's anything wrong with the stairs at all. That was just a cover to keep us out."
"Still, it's a depressing thought to come hundreds of miles and wind up 10 feet out of reach of the object of your desire. I don't know what I'd do. jump from one of the windows, I bet.
Me too, but only because of the shame of lacking basic problem-solving skills. Get moving.